Just a quick heads up, we are going to be changing our release schedules from Sundays to later in the week, like Tuesday or Wednesday. This is to not overlap as much with Board Game Bros and kind of give us a little more time to do things over the weekend than we currently have. So thank you for being patient with us as we kind of move towards that.
I'm connecting to the internet.
Internet.
Networking software.
World Wide Web for the computer today.
Computer.
NetSurfer Pro.
All right, we're going to do a completely non-political episode. So we're going to talk about only things that aren't political. Like, for example, Run the Jewels. That's a good one. That's not political in any way.
Yeah, yeah. I'm so tired of, like, going onto the internet every day and seeing politics everywhere. I go to Twitter.com and it's everywhere. I go to YouTube, it's everywhere. I go to USA.gov, politics all over that. So you know what? Yeah, only apolitical artists for this episode. Damn it. Like Kanye West. I like the song where he's like, a boogity scoop. A scoop-a-doo-boo-boo-doo-boop.
Right. You know, Rage Against the Machine. They have a lot of great apolitical things.
Yeah, yeah. Childish Gambino, I like his, like, bonfire song where he's like, it's a bonfire, bring the marshmallows.
Yeah, let's see, what else? Bob Dylan actually has a lot of great apolitical stuff from back in the day.
Yeah, yeah, and System of a Down, there's pretty good, you know, light listening apolitical music from them.
Right, Anti-Flag.
Welcome back to NetSurfer Pro, a whirlwind wide through the World Wide Web. I'm your co-host, Matt, and with me is the main host.
Galen?
Yeah.
We have, of course, Freaky Friday'd.
Yes.
Which is today, why we're in a universe where all those things are apolitical, I suppose.
Exactly. Have you ever heard of the Mandela Effect? It's like that, but real. Today we're going to be talking about another heavily apolitical subject, which is Green Day, or specifically the American Idiot album from Green Day.
Green Day is a reference to the 420 smoke de weed.
Trans rights and human rights. Anyway, I have context for, like, the world at the time that American Idiot came out.
Right.
I don't know if you have context for, like, the specific, like, creation of the album.
Yeah, we can just go into the fact corner immediately.
Yeah.
All right.
The fact corner.
So, American Idiot is an album released by Green Day, the three-man rock band of Billy Joe Armstrong, Mike Dirnt, and Trey Cool. It was released in September 2004 as their seventh studio album. So their 2000 album Warning didn't do quite well for them. And they, after like a lot of discussion and sort of hard conversations, they decided they wanted to seek a new direction. The first attempt at making this album after Warning, which I believe was Cigarettes and Heartache, I want to say? Something like that. The master tapes were stolen in 2002 after they had recorded like 30 songs or 30 demos.
Wow.
When that happened, they were kind of trying to find the direction they wanted to go, and they decided to make a completely new album from scratch, that album becoming American Idiot. And they wanted to make another album that was very political to harken back to their like really punk roots that they started with. And through this time, Billy Joe Armstrong especially was inspired by like the Beatles and their progression of their sound in deciding to make the album a concept album. One interesting thing is that during recording, they had a jam session where band members separately composed 30-second riffs, that jam session then becoming the song Homecoming and inspiring them to make another song, Jesus of Suburbia. The album was their first album to reach number one on the Billboard charts, and it won the 2005 Grammy for Best Rock Album and later spawned a Broadway musical. And yeah, so it had a lot of other radio hit singles. You've probably heard many of them, like the eponymous American Idiot, Holiday, Boulevard of Broken Dreams, Wake Me Up When September Ends, all very well-known rock songs of the day.
Yeah.
And arguably, I would say this was sort of like a Hail Mary for the band. I think that is less fact corner and more interpretation corner. But
I think it's pretty true, though, just because, like you said, they were on sort of a lull at their at the time that American Idiot came out, where they weren't gone, but they weren't really in the forefront of anything. They weren't extremely popular. But then American Idiot came out, and honestly, they're still around today. And it's a little bit hard to. I would argue that they might not be around today as noteworthy as they are. As how many people know Green Day currently, even if by name alone, if American Idiot had not been the smash hit that it was.
Right. They definitely had notoriety in the 90s, thanks to their albums like Dookie, with songs like Basket Case or Welcome to Paradise.
Yeah.
But I think those, while being popular rock songs, weren't quite as at the forefront of the zeitgeist as American Idiot. And you know what else happened in 2000 and 2004 in that sort of time period that was at the forefront of the American zeitgeist?
Why, I believe that would be the release of SSX Tricky and SSX 3.
Yes, everybody started listening to Autopilot Off.
So, to explain the zeitgeist, because... I think that when you're our age, which is Gen Z / millennial, maybe I'm on the exact cusp. Yeah, literally, though. I am 1996. That's my birth year. I am on the exact cusp of Gen Z / millennial. And I think you honestly kind of fit the halfway between vibe as well. Yeah. Our generation might not remember exactly how things were in this era, the post 9/11 era, when post 9/11 was immediately happening. So I'm going to lay a little bit of groundwork, and I will admit I am sort of paraphrasing the videos of protest music of the Bush era by Lindsay Ellis. And the Train Records of, I think it's This American Life by Madonna, the video done by Todd in the Shadows. So I am sort of, if you want more in-depth dives into what I'm about to discuss, you can go ahead and look those videos up. But to sort of paraphrase, the 2001 Iraq War came about because of September 11th, 9/11, when the trains hit the World Trade Center buildings. And there was an immediate America wanted a retaliation immediately afterwards, but by 2003 even, there was a lot of unease of there was a lot of questions that weren't being answered, where we kind of had a bit of a shaky are we actually doing the right thing sort of thing. It wasn't like Vietnam, where everything was really up in the air and everybody was very, very, everybody in air quotes, of course, but a lot of people were very, very shaky to begin with, because with September 11th, there was the very big, very noteworthy thing that happened. But by 2004, there were, shifting perspectives on it. A lot of people were getting a lot more uneasy. But the trick here is that in modern day, we have, obviously the gag we just did is apolitical, but we have a lot of people talking very openly about very big problems with America. We have a lot of, rap singles that are about police brutality. We have a lot of, singles that are directly about the struggles of being a woman, even being gay, or just straight up being black. We have a lot of music that is about those problems. But around 2004, the singles we had was shit like Toby Keith saying, "We'll put a boot in your ass because it's the American way." It was a lot of hoorah, American nationalism. Like, hell yeah, we're great. We're doing the good thing by sending them boys out to solve the problem in Middle East. Like, it was a lot of that on the top 40. And this isn't to say that there wasn't protest music. There was. System of a Down had BYOB.
A lot of Kanye West's music at the time had anti-American undertones in general.
Yeah, Kanye West, back when West was...
I think Jesus Walks mentions it. I'm not super sure. Gorillaz had anti-war stuff with Dirty Harry, I think it was, off Demon Days.
Yeah, there were a lot of protest music, but it wasn't like protest music on the radio like it was in the late 60s, early 70s with like Creedence Clearwater Revival or War, the song sung by Edwin Starr, I think is his name.
Or even you know, there's no like Fuck the Police or Killing in the Name of.
Yeah, which was, you know, that was like 1992 onward was a lot of that like punk and like really dirty hip hop that was very, very willing to tackle the issues of America and make a stand. But we didn't have a lot of that revolution come 9/11. But there is one big exception, of course, and that big exception is American Idiot, which hit number one in 2004 and kind of really was the only like big protest song or like protest album that came out that really hit with the American zeitgeist. For clarity, the Dixie Chicks.
Oh.
The Dixie Chicks, you might have heard of them. They made a statement against the war and against George Bush before a show in like Britain or something. Their careers basically stopped existing. They got, in modern parlance, canceled basically just for saying, "We think Bush isn't doing the right thing." Like, that was where the American zeitgeist was at the time that this came out.
I should also say, to kind of back us up a bit, American Idiot was especially a big deal with white people.
Yes, that is also true.
There's definitely anti-war music that resonated with, like, minority communities, you know, people of color, LGBTQ, that type of stuff. But American Idiot set, you know, it really impacted... like the middle class, sort of.
Yeah, the poor working middle class, as it were. The
upper lower like... middle class. Which is a really dumb term. Like, it's just sectioning things off further than it needs to be. But yeah.
Yeah.
So like, I think it's not that we're trying to take this really, like, you know, white centric approach. It's more so that it's notable because it worked for a demographic that normally just doesn't care as much.
Yeah. And even more, I think that not caring what is a big theme throughout American Idiot. Like, I'll be talking a lot about the, like, anger and apathy are two, like, sides of a coin that I think resonates very well throughout the themes of American Idiot that I'll be bringing up no small amount.
Right. So, yeah, I think it's definitely worth keeping in mind all of the sort of like, oh, I should also mention that nowadays it's also pretty well understood that a large part, maybe most of the Iraq War was about oil in like natural reserves.
Yeah.
And that like, you know, the like conquest of another country, another people just to get oil is also majorly tied in with sort of some of the themes in the album.
Yeah.
So I think that's a pretty good like overview of the climate at the time. I want to give more of a overview of the album itself now.
Yes.
So I briefly mentioned earlier that this is a concept album, meaning that it is an album that's not just a collection of songs, but those songs have some sort of link between themselves. It is also a rock opera in that it is telling a story through the songs, like an actual direct narrative. Now, not all concept albums are rock operas. You have things like, I guess the only thing I can come up with off the top of my head is like GNV FLA by Less Than Jake, which has a lot of songs that, you know, kind of contribute to the themes of the album, but there's no like narrative, there's no plot. Whereas rock opera is usually something like The Who's Tommy or The Wall by Pink Floyd. These are like, yeah, they have a story going on. There's something to be said narratively. And while the narrative isn't complex in American Idiot, it is there. And it's used more of as a vehicle to sort of explore this sort of perspective in time. The main character is Jesus of Suburbia. Then the other two main characters are Saint Jimmy and what's her name. So like these names are all like placeholder names, or like, you know, they're not the actual names of the characters. And that's because them as characters isn't as important as what they represent. And so keep that in mind as we go through like the plot and the story and then the themes itself, that these aren't really deep characters in themselves.
Yeah.
It's more like a parable.
Yeah. If we sat here and like explained the by text story of American Idiot, it would be a very simple story.
In fact, but I have a plot analysis that does that. So it starts off with Jesus of Suburbia in a small town of Jingletown, California. Jesus of Suburbia does not feel comfortable at home, feels discontent, has sort of a broken home. And so he runs away and leaves town, moves to the city, but he soon finds that the city life is depressing and solitary. Feeling this sort of identity crisis, he develops or creates Saint Jimmy, a sort of alternate personality. And Saint Jimmy is this like chaotic, violent personality that wants to like do drugs, commit crime, maybe be gay, unsure about that one.
This was 2004, before being gay was a thing.
Well, actually, fun fact, before by this being point, gay was developed, Billy Joe Armstrong had come out as bisexual.
Oh, that's actually really cool.
Yeah, so he's like, allowed to say the F slur.
Like, that's very unironically cool of a fact to come about from my dumb joke.
The Jesus of Suburbia as Saint Jimmy has like followers that are also more just like stranded lost youth. And eventually Jesus of Suburbia meets what's her name, an activist that he falls in love with. But while they try to pursue a relationship, Jesus of Suburbia isn't able to be intimate or affectionate, often leaving what's her name alone. And so what's her name leaves him and sends him this letter that causes Jesus of Suburbia to have a catharsis. And he realizes that even though he wants to believe he's some sort of savior of the world, he's really no savior at all. And he's just sort of like been living a terrible life. Realizing that he's not dead yet, he can still turn his life around. He forgets the life of a savior. Saint Jimmy leaves or is dead or disappears, what have you. Saint Jesus of Suburbia finds a desk job that he hates and fantasizes of like doing crime or doing something cool with his life. He gets a letter from an old friend who grew up to be a rock star and no longer wants to stay in contact because Jesus keeps complaining. And then finally, as Jesus of Suburbia is just alone, he returns to where he grew up, never really finding a home of his own to spread his wings. And even years later, he still misses what's her name, even though he forces himself to move on. So that's pretty much it. Like I said, there's no developments, you know. There's no like Jesus of Suburbia being really good at pinball or anything. Or there's no like carpet crawlers crawling across the carpet. No, it's really just like these three characters in some like vague descriptions of what they do. And then more precise descriptions of the main character's future. But where it you know, doesn't care about those, like I said, it really dives more into the theme of the album.
Yeah, it wants to keep things as like sort of vague as far as just direct actions go, because Jesus of Suburbia is a vehicle for, like, it's a vehicle for the listener and also a vehicle for a lot of the themes and a lot of the anxieties of the era.
Yes.
Do we want to start with American Idiot then, the title track?
So, American Idiot is the title track, the lead single, like the main song. American Idiot is more of just like sort of a mission statement. You know, it's don't want to be an American idiot, but then it explains kind of what the American idiot is. It's somebody who eats up propaganda like chips, somebody who's racist and xenophobic, you know, just full of hatred. You know, he says the redneck agenda in the second verse, that sort of direct, like, attack against people who are all, you know, gun-tooting, flag-saluting, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah. The American Idiot is a very good thesis because it's the contrast of, you know, being a song that is kind of anti-America, not exactly anti-America, but more like a statement of, I swear I will not be like the rest of this nation, while also being a song that is extremely upbeat and very good to sing along to and very unironically, like, fun and good. But, like, it also deals with, you know, the problems of, like, I really like the line all across the alien nation, because the alien nation can mean something like, say, alien nation in the sense of, like, a whole bunch of foreigners intruding upon us, but I think it's more like alienation, haha. I'm surprised I didn't realize that earlier.
That's the whole joke.
Yeah. But it's alienation in the sense of, you know, we are increasingly becoming estranged from each other. At the time, it was because, well, you're either aware of the problems with, you know, a post 9/11 world and are thus kind of like really hesitant to really engage with people, or you're super into it, which means that certainly, you know, you have a crowd to go to, but also, like, the crowd to go to is very openly xenophobic, very openly jingoist, very openly kind of horrible. So, like, the America that is the idiot America is a sense of community, but it's a very bad community.
Right.
It's the community you don't want to be.
To me, it sort of juxtaposes America classically as this, like, home of immigrants, and the current day America of we don't like anybody else. You know,
yeah,
I think that's a very potent line for that reason. I think another one that is referenced or brought up multiple times is the television dreams of tomorrow. There's two ways I sort of interpret this. One of them is the dreams that are broadcast on television, you know, like the dreams of being a rock star, a movie star, some sort of celebrity, you know, a famous athlete. They're dreams of, like, the kids of tomorrow that they're selling. But, you know, the Billy Joe says we're not the ones who are meant to follow because we're unlikely to reach that level of success. So we're meant to be the ones who are discontent and live these kind of just average lives or shitty lives. We're not the ones who are meant to go for those dreams. But also, if you think of the television being personified, it's like, the television doesn't like what's on TV. It's dreaming of tomorrow for a day where it doesn't have to display the current news.
Yeah, I like that interpretation a lot, because that also fits very well with a much later song of Wake Me Up When September Ends, which is, to quote Lindsay Ellis, a song about not wanting to live through the time that you're currently alive.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, even it's that wonderful contrast where the television, the media, the new media that is sort of enrapturing all of America is also a media that really wants to just get past where we currently are.
Yeah. I don't have much else to say about American Idiot, other than I have a brief aside about the Weird Al parody of the song. So I really want to bring this up. Weird Al parodied American Idiot with the song Canadian Idiot, which was released on his album Straight Outta Linwood. Canadian Idiot is a really good parody because it presents the narrator of the song as the American idiot that Green Day represented. The lyrics of Canadian Idiot are about somebody thinking that all the people from Canada are weird and like awkward and like they gotta be up to something, so it ends with the narrator calling for a preemptive airstrike on Canada. And so for like, for one thing, this is sort of more or less a reference to the reason for invading Iraq. You know, like, we have reason to believe they have weapons of mass destruction. But also, what's really important is that Weird Al does not punch down with this parody. Like, it works because Canada is often seen as better than America in many ways. There's not a lot to actually be angry about, or like, there's not people who are super, I mean, there might be people who are racist against Canadians, but it's not as widespread as something like people who are racist against Mexicans, for example. That's another country that's connected to America, but if Weird Al were to make a song about being racist towards Mexicans, it would only empower racist people.
Yeah.
And with like, the things that Weird Al complains about being, like, not bringing guns to the mall, which is really great, it's like, it really makes those xenophobic fears seem childish in comparison. It really, like, plays out, like, this xenophobic person being needlessly paranoid about nothing.
Yeah.
And so, it's just worth noting, if you're gonna write a parody like that, pay attention to who you're actually making fun of.
Yeah, God. We could do a whole ass, like, deep dive into, like, how to actually do parody and satire. I hate, complete side tangent, I hate the you couldn't make Blazing Saddles today bullshit argument or whatever, or like, oh, you couldn't make this today, because the shit that everybody says you couldn't make today is really smart, and you could make them today. It's just that the people who say, oh, you couldn't make a movie where you say the N-word today, just want to say the N-word.
Yeah.
They don't actually want to say anything of any worth. They just want to say a slur and get away with it. No, go watch Blazing Saddle. It's fucking great. Anyway,
back to this political satire.
Yes.
So after American Idiot is the first song of like the story of the album, Jesus of Suburbia. This is 9 minutes. It's a pretty long song, again, made of multiple, like, movements. It introduces Jesus of Suburbia as a character, and then goes through kind of Jesus's early life until he leaves home. There's a lot to unpack in this album, including this is where it introduces two more of, like, the repeated motifs, the lyrical motifs, not instrumental motifs, in the album. One of which is Rage and Love, a concept that is repeated many times throughout the entire album. In Jesus of Suburbia, Jesus says he is the son of rage and love. It's the first line of the song. That just, pay attention to the rage and love, because that'll appear many, many times. And then in the second movement of the song, it talks about home is where the heart is, or the motto. Notably, so he brings this up in reference to 7-Eleven, and he says, like, 7-Eleven, where I was taught the motto was just a lie. And then the next line is, it says, home is where your heart is. The actual motto for 7-Eleven is, oh, thank heaven. So it could be that when it refers to the motto was just a lie, it's saying, like, heaven's a lie or something. Or it's some other completely different motto that they're talking about. But home is where your heart is really poignant, because he then says, but everyone's heart doesn't beat the same. And Jesus's heart is beating out of time. And the connection between heartbeats and home is another, like, constant metaphor throughout the album. That, like, your home is where your heart is, because, you know, that's, like, a very typical cutesy sort of crocheted cross-stitch thing to put on the wall. But also, like, your heartbeat would be normal or, like, even if you were comfortable. And if you're not comfortable, if you're stressed or anxious, it beats out of time. And so the, like, the literal, like, everyone's heart doesn't beat the same because they don't have that comfortable home, it's something that is felt as, like, an anxiety, a sign of stress by the character. Also, yeah, note that the album cover is the heart with a hand grenade. That itself is actually, like, directly said in a later song. But it both is sort of rage and love. You know, it's a weapon and a heart. But it's also the heart beating out of time.
Yeah. Jesus of Suburbia does a good job of setting up a lot of the, like, lyrical juxtapositions.
You got it.
Okay, juxtaposition. but it's also a very good song for it is a song called Jesus of Suburbia that uses the Bible motif very well. Like, Bible motifs are obviously, you know, a little bit direct, a little bit obvious in many cases, but I think that Jesus of Suburbia uses the obviousness to its advantage. Like, there's not a lot of specific beating around the bush. It directly says, like, the Bible of none of the above, or get my television fix sitting on my crucifix. So, like, it understands that we are going to present you a song that is going to reference the Bible, so let's just directly say what we're going to compare these things to. And I think it does it very well. Like, sitting on my crucifix of, you know, the couch is just my crucifix. I think it's a very good example of, like, how they take
well, it's very, like, they get out of the way with the like, they don't need to worry about being subtle. That's not the point. The point is being direct so that it can hit with full force.
Yeah.
Part of the strength of it is that it brings out these imagery immediately. It is just, like, really direct with it.
Yeah. And I think it, like, I think that also helps with the, like, Jesus of Suburbia is a character in this, but it's also the vehicle for the listener, where, like, at this time, I cannot imagine that anyone would have trouble, you know, identifying with, like, the character who just sort of sits and watches TV all day, because, God, what else is there to do? You know, it's a vehicle for the listener, because it's, like, certainly Jesus of Suburbia is his own character, and he will have his own story, but the, like, the anxieties that he deals with, the, you know, the 7-Eleven, where the motto is just a lie, it's the, like, you know, these are the modern day, like, these are our modern day gods.
Right.
These so, are, yeah.
So, I really want to dive into that, because the first movement, the actual, like, Jesus of Suburbia movement, it goes a lot into, like, establish Jesus of Suburbia and, like, his daily routine, like, you know, on a steady diet of soda pop and Ritalin and all that. Or, like, to fall in love and fall in debt. Like, Jesus of Suburbia is this, like, archetypical suburban person who drinks sodas, takes ADHD medicine, grows up to do drugs and alcohol to deal with stress and debt. And, like, people don't believe in that because they don't want to believe that that is, like, the reality for so many people. You know, it's like, in the land of make-believe that don't believe in me, it's like, they can make-believe so many other things, like growing up to be a big movie star, or being in a world where the war is justified, but they don't believe in the reality that's, like, right around them, that, like, people are living these very stagnant, unfulfilled lives. And so yeah. Jesus of Suburbia, he's not, like, he's not really holy or a savior. He's more of just, like, an outcast, kind of like Jesus.
Which, like, fits very well with, you know, Jesus was certainly divine, but he was also a man.
Right.
And, like, I think what helps this album still resonate today is that, like, we still kind of have this problem where, you know, we have the archetype of, like, the millennial who's hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt, doing a job that doesn't pay nearly enough, you know, doing gig. Our generation is the generation of gig work. Our generation is the generation of, like, constantly being on that grind. And so, you know, when people in bad faith talk about those people, they don't talk about anybody who like exists. They talk about, oh, you know, we can't cancel debt because that's just a free pass to all the people who, you know, willy-nilly decided to go to college. Or, oh, you know, we can't raise the minimum wage because, you know, people don't even like, you know, no one really exists who has a minimum, who has multiple minimum wage jobs just to make debt. It's this like Jesus of Suburbia is certainly an affluent person, but also like the stress and anxieties of Jesus of Suburbia are also the stress and anxieties of people who aren't nearly as affluent.
Right. And then also the other sort of take on this is that in a more abstract sense, the redneck America sees Jesus as not even like a savior or a kind person, but an excuse to persecute, you know, just like people who are so into Jesus that they hate everybody else, that type of stuff.
Yeah.
They don't actually believe in what Jesus preached. They believe Jesus existed, but they don't really follow him per se. And so the Americans that don't believe in the Jesus of Suburbia, the Jesus of Suburbia is the one that excuses all that. It's, you know, they don't actually believe in Jesus's words.
Yeah. I also really like the line of, you know, we are the kids of war and peace from Anaheim to the Middle East. We are the stories and disciples of the Jesus of Suburbia, where like it goes further to sort of make the point of, you know, this Jesus of Suburbia is everyone. This Jesus of Suburbia is all of us who grew up watching terrorism become a household name or a household word and just sort of had nothing else, like could do nothing else about it but like shrug and change the channel.
Yeah. A few other things I want to mention about this song as a whole. In the City of the Damned bit, for one thing, there is another biblical reference with graffiti in a bathroom stall being the holy scriptures of the shopping mall, which I think is kind of funny. In the music video for the song, the character playing Jesus goes into a bathroom, writes just a bunch of shit on the walls, and then passes out. And I think there's something interesting about like the feeling that the only way to get your message out is to write it on a bathroom where people have to look at it because they've got nothing else to look at. Also, just, you know, a lot of bathroom stall stuff is graffiti that doesn't really mean anything, but it's something that you see often, so like it kind of becomes ingrained in your head.
Yeah.
The reference to 7-Eleven being the center of the earth, and like the end of the world, is sort of like in this small town, there's nothing else to do but hang out in the parking lot of 7-Eleven, which is, you know, like I can kind of understand that. It's not something I've ever done, but I get the idea of like the best place to hang out is just somewhere where you can get like a candy bar and a soda and just sit in a car. But that's still like super boring. It's just all they kind of have.
Yeah, I love the center of the earth is the end of the world is the 7-Eleven, because like that obviously does have parallels as well to, you know, the corporatization of America and how, you know, the shit like the local Walmart might be the only business in a small town. But like it's also it also pairs well with the you know, the graffiti being holy scriptures and stuff like that. It's our generation is the generation where 7-Eleven is God.
Yeah.
Like it's the generation where, you know, we don't have you know, a temple to go to pray. We have, you know, certainly some churches, but like there's no modern religion. We just have to make do with, you know, we just have to make do with talking to each other in parking lots of shit that's open 24 hours a day.
So the last thing I want to say about Jesus of Suburbia is that the last movement or one of the last movements is this extended Johnny Cash reference. Maybe not solely a reference to Johnny Cash, but it plays the a riff that I think is pretty much just the riff from the Ring of Fire.
The chord progression is the yeah, the chord progression is the same as Ring of Fire.
Right. And that is as Jesus is talking about leaving home. And so, like, in a way, it's like leaving the hurricane that is Jingletown or whatever you isn't much better because it's still entering a Ring of Fire. Also, the Ring of Fire could just be like the county line in a way. Also, he does mention that he's walked this line 1,000,001 fucking times or whatever, which is a reference to Johnny Cash's I Walk the Line.
Yeah. And I think within like the song or within the narrative, that could also be like, I've thought about running away from home so many times. This time I'm going to fucking do it.
Right. Yeah. Okay. That's Jesus of Suburbia. The next song is Holiday, which I think is the most anti-war outright.
Yeah.
The most obliquely anti-war. Like, a lot of them reference it or, like, have that sort of theme, but this one is the one that directly criticizes the government for their participation. You know, like, it immediately starts with, like, a shame, the ones who died without a name and all that. The bridge is just, like, a senator or a representative being, like, super war-hungry, xenophobic, racist, just, like, calling for the death of everybody that doesn't agree with America.
Yeah. Fun little side fact. Pulverize the Eiffel Towers to criticize your government. You might not know this, but France was against the war. And in the White House cafeteria, as protest against France, who were protesting us, we changed the name of French fries to Freedom Fries.
That's
like
what
French
that
toast
was.
To Freedom Toast. Yeah.
See, so, I thought it was like an example of just like destroying a international monument, but one that is not from like a country people are usually racist against.
Oh, that's also like it's multi-layered, but I think the direct context needs to be said, because one, it's hilarious, and two, when he says like pulverize the Eiffel Towers or criticize your government, it isn't just you know, a vague sort of sentence or like a vague gesture. It's like a reference to something that America actually did, where we would, you know, we would just straight up have foreign relations that would like be strained just because they were critical of us.
Yeah.
In this instance.
There is one line in particular from the second verse that I really want to touch on.
Yeah.
Which is there's a flag wrapped around a score of men, a gag, a plastic bag on a monument. So obviously this is referring to the practice of wrapping flags around the coffins of dead soldiers as they return from war. But the imagery of the plastic bag is so huge.
Yeah.
Because it compares the flag to a plastic bag as being, like, disposable. Like, they don't care about it. It's garbage. But also, when do you get plastic bags? From shopping. So, like, it's saying, like, the flag is being used, and the soldiers are being used as, like, currency to get oil or what have you. And then, when you've bought that, you throw away the bag in whatever unnecessary stuff is inside. So, like, if you get a receipt and you don't care about the receipt, you'll just throw it away with the plastic bag. That's what's kind of being compared here, is that these are people. It's a score of men, you know, a whole lot of people that died, but they're being thrown away like disposable shopping bags.
Yeah, I also like the imagery because I think it, like, I think it's also a good dichotomy where, like, a flag wrapped around a score of men is, you know, burying somebody with the flag over them is a sign of respect, but a plastic bag on a monument, you know, messing with statues and monuments with just random crap is sort of a sign of protest itself. And so it's this interesting dichotomy as well, where like a plastic bag on a monument, you might look at and go, hey, that's, you know, that's terrible. That's disrespectful. That's trashy. But is it not equally trashy to be sacrificing the lives of American soldiers for basically nothing.
Right.
It's this, like, one of these is apparently respectful and one of these is, you know, random throwaway garbage. And for some reason, the one that ends in countless deaths is the one that's respectful.
Right. Also, there is the fact that he says a gag, which could refer to a gag order on, like, you know, why are these soldiers dead? We can't say. Or a joke, like, you know, the way they're treating these lives is, it's got to be like a gag, or like they're treating it like a joke, or like a morbid reaction, you know, like laughing in the face of loss.
Yeah.
There's also the, you know, the another protester has crossed the line to find the money's on the other side, which is very much like the money's either on the other side of the world, and that's why they're fighting, or it's like there's more money to be made in pro-war than anti-war.
Yeah.
And so people will abandon their morals because of the money.
Yeah, I love that line so much as well, because, like, I think that also is a very timeless line in current day, where, like, for no small amount of time, it was very profitable to put on the face of resistance, but not really say anything. You know, it's the Kylie Jenner Pepsi sort ad sort of thing, where, like, nowadays we have, thankfully, a lot of, you know, a lot of great artists who make a living saying really, really important statements and actually fighting for causes. But for a very long time, it was very, very profitable to go just far enough and say, yeah, I'm also certainly protesting for things, but not actually saying anything. You can't actually, like, make a statement that will alienate people. That's not where the money is. It's in putting on the facade.
Right. Also, the crossing the line is one that's very much like a picket line, you know. If somebody crosses a picket line, they are abandoning the protesters because they're being selfish. They care about, like, you know, just getting their own and not about the work or the plights of everybody else.
Yeah.
And so that's another very poignant way that this still manifests itself to this day.
Yeah. Do we want to move on to Boulevard?
Yeah.
An interesting thing, actually, now that we're at it as well, is that a lot of the songs are paired. So, like, Holiday directly goes into Boulevard of Broken Dreams.
Right. This is actually kind of annoying. On Spotify, they actually have these only as the paired versions, which means that if you want to only listen to the second half of the that pair of songs, then you have to skip ahead a bit. Which,
yeah,
boggles me, because Boulevard was, like, their most popular single from the album. So, like, you can't listen to Boulevard by itself on Spotify. But also, my favorite song in the album, or at least one of my favorites, is the second half of one of these pairs. And so that bothers me. Luckily, the CD release, which is what I have at home, has them all separate tracks. So, like, I can just do that.
Yeah.
But not on Spotify.
Boulevard of Broken Dreams, you might know from the popular 2005 Kidz Bop version, which I only found out is a thing because I'm looking at the lyrics list right now on Google. And I'm seeing Boulevard of Broken Dreams, Kidz Bop 2005.
Oh, no. I don't even know if I want to know what they did.
Color between the lines. That looks good and everything's all right.
Read between the lines. That was a show on PBS Kids. Nice. I was going to say, you might know this song from the fantastic YouTube video, MS Paint Boulevard of Broken Dreams Lip Sync, which is one of the greatest YouTube videos of all time. Like, I'm not taking questions. No arguments. Boulevard's really popular, obviously. It's pretty much just Jesus being alone. There is references to some of the other ongoing, like, motifs. What's it called? My shallow heart's the only thing that's beating. Jesus doesn't have much of a home. It's very shallow. But he's still alive. His heart's still beating. He's still there, even if it's beating out of time or in some way or another. He's still just kind of alive.
Yeah. He's alive but aimless.
Yeah.
I also think that My Shadow's the Only One That Walks Beside Me is a sort of like allusion to the later Saint Jimmy who comes out, the sort of alternate persona.
Right, yeah. And also the borderline that divides me somewhere in my mind is both referencing the line from before with like part of Jesus still wants to be at home and go back to where he was. Part of him wants to stay out of home and be in the city. But also it's like the whole alternate personality thing.
Yeah. I also do want to throw mention to check my vital signs to know I'm still alive and I walk alone. I know that like the motif of I have to do something to know I'm still alive is a popular one in music. You know, I hurt myself today to see if I still feel, that sort of thing. But it's also one that I'm a super sucker for. And so like, I love that line a lot. I love I really like the motif and the idea of, I'm not even sure if I'm still alive, but I guess that technically speaking, my heart is still beating. My shallow heart's the only thing that's beating.
Yeah.
It's a very poignant and very important sort of like ennui.
Next song is Are We the Waiting, which is another one that's just sort of like the depression and loneliness of Jesus of Suburbia. He talks about like city burning down in his mind, but he's not actually burning it down despite how much he really wants to. He's just dreaming of like tearing the whole thing apart.
Which also has allusion to the rage and love, the story of my life. It also has the line that Jesus of Suburbia is a lie. Which it's obviously sort of like going into the Saint Jimmy, the Saint Jimmy persona. But I also love that because that pops up in my favorite song of the album. And I love it because it's the first sign of like, it plays with this motif that like the Jesus of Suburbia is Jesus, but also isn't. It's that tension between like, you know, Jesus, I brought up that, you know, our Jesus, our everyday man is someone who goes to 7-Eleven. Our scriptures are shit that someone's written on the walls. But like, it's also that tension with like, obviously, it's not Jesus, though, right? Our Jesus isn't just some random asshole on Twitter, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's that idea of like, there has to be something more.
Yeah, like, both Jesus the character isn't a savior messiah figure like he wants to be, but also that, like, we shouldn't just settle for that being the truth, in a way.
Yeah.
So, Are We the Waiting gets interrupted by Saint Jimmy, more or less, which is pretty interesting to me.
Yeah.
It's, like, kind of a real sucker punch. It switches to Saint Jimmy, which is this much faster, much more upbeat song. Saint Jimmy, it just introduces him pretty much. He mentions like being a teenage assassin, and it mentions like his followers. It's really unclear if Saint Jimmy has actual followers and if he's actually doing assassinating. He says, you know, he's here to execute some fun or whatever. I think on one hand, part of me believes this is a Fight Club-esque, like, somebody who wants to kill executives or whatever.
Yeah.
But also, on the other hand, I wouldn't be surprised if that was just being, like, Saint Jimmy wants to, like, take in these lost youth but doesn't actually help them in any way, being a literal teenager assassin, which is really morbid. I understand, but, like, it's not like Saint Jimmy's a good character, a good person.
Yeah. I just want to bring up that I believe the Broadway play has a subplot where Jesus of Suburbia is sent to war. And so I think that Saint Jimmy could also, if that is like, if we're looking at that specific version of the story, could also be like the oorah personality that develops from war. I'm not going to continue with that interpretation with like how we talk about it with the album as it is, just because I've never seen the Broadway play. But like, I think that could also be, you could also interpret that with some of the lines like Suicide Commando that your mama talked about, or the other references to like murder and being a teenage assassin.
It could also be that Saint Jimmy is Jesus's like way of pushing out his teenage self.
Yeah.
Like, he doesn't want to be that, like, lost kid. He wants to be an adult that's able to do things. Now, yeah. Saint Jimmy also says he's the patron saint of denial, which both, like, people who don't believe in something are denying that it exists. So, like, Saint Jimmy is the patron saint of Jesus, who people don't believe in. But also, like, Jesus of Suburbia is in denial about who he is. He starts to realize, like, Jesus of Suburbia is a lie, but that line of thinking gets caught off by Saint Jimmy. So, like, Saint Jimmy is Jesus being in denial about him not being a messiah.
Yeah.
And then Saint Jimmy says he's the needle in the vein of the establishment, which, like, that's not necessarily something that means that he wants to stop the establishment. It's more like he's a representation of the like seediness, the dark side or what have you of the establishment, but he's not really combating it.
Yeah, it's the air of, like I just mentioned, it's the air of revolution, but without actually following through. Because like a needle in the vein of the establishment could be a heroin needle or something similar, which means that it's actually stimulating the establishment. It's instead of being a corporate drone, instead of being a cog in the machine, I'm going to be something that on the surface hurts the machine, but like, does it really hurt it?
Right. Jimmy is an industry plant.
I also think that it's interesting that Saint Jimmy talks, like almost every time Saint Jimmy is brought up, it is in some way violent. And I think that's this perspective kind of came about from an Australian friend of mine. But like, the America is very violent, like, and I don't mean even just like, you know, on a world stage or anything like that. Americans think a lot in terms of violence. You know, a lot of the daily life of Americans is, you know, police violence, school shootings, you know, the war machine. There's just sort of a latent underlying horror to just being an American almost. And I think it's interesting that when Saint Jimmy pops up, he reflects that a lot. He reflects that a lot where, like, even if he isn't literally an assassin, literally a commando, you know, he talks a lot about these really violent acts. And every time he kind of comes up, he is in some way related to that violence.
Right. Saint Jimmy is the television dream of being like an action movie character, like Rambo or Bruce Willis or, you know, what have you, mixed with the television dream of being like a rock star who does drugs.
Yeah.
Finally, one last thing I want to say about Saint Jimmy is that he says he's comedy and tragedy, which is another interpretation of Rage and Love.
Yeah. I think it's also worth noting that like Saint Jimmy is a negative figure, but I also think that Saint Jimmy is sort of like portrayed as a bit of an inevitable figure, an inevitable, like this is what the alienation of modern day brings us to sort of thing, which I only bring up to justify the fact that I think this song is fucking banging and I love it. Like If I 100% accept that Saint Jimmy is a bad character, then I also have to accept that the fact that I love this song and will sing it to myself kind of means that I'm rooting for the bad guy.
Yeah.
So,
after Saint Jimmy is "Give me the Novocaine" or "Give me Novocaine," which is about drug addiction.
Yeah. A lot of good drug imagery as well. Novocaine, obviously, like the very opening is, you know, bittersweet migraine in my head. It's like a throbbing toothache of the mind. And Novocaine is what is used to numb you, or what was used to numb you in a dentist's office. So a lot of very good imagery of, you know, using drugs to numb the toothache that is being alive.
Right. There's not much else to say about it otherwise, though, other than it's kind of it's kind of implied that the reason he's doing these is because of Saint Jimmy. Like, Jimmy says it's better than here, which sounds like Jimmy says it's better than air. Like, Saint Jimmy is the one selling these. Yeah. But again, Gimme Novocaine is interrupted by another song, which is She's a Rebel. She's a Rebel being the introduction of What's Her Name, which is the love to Saint Jimmy's rage. What's Her Name is like this like activist, like, you know, they call her a mother of a bomb, but they also call her like she sings of revolution. She brings us liberation. It's sort of implied that she is the actual activist in the story. She's the one who is putting an effort to change things and like get her voice heard.
Yeah. This is also where the holding on my heart like a hand grenade imagery comes in. Really good line.
Yeah. So, you know, they get in a relationship with each other, and the holding on my heart like a hand grenade is potent because, for one thing, it's the heart hand grenade metaphor, but also it sort of implies that they're not going to last. If she's holding onto his heart like a hand grenade, that's something that's going to explode eventually. And it does. In Extraordinary Girl, which is the next song, it pretty much just shows, like, they're not in a good spot with their relationship. If she is, you know, she's alone crying every night. Jesus isn't really able to relate or be intimate. You know, like, he lacks a carriage in his mind, like a child left behind. His life has not led him to a place where he can love another person, pretty much.
Yeah. I do like to go back to She's a Rebel for one quick second. I love the line where it's sort of describing her, but it's also in a question. It's, is she dreaming what I'm thinking? Is she the mother of all bombs going to detonate? Is she trouble like I'm trouble? I like those lines a lot because it's describing her, but it's also describing the doubt that Jesus of Suburbia feels, where it's like, is she trouble like I'm trouble? Tells you that she is trouble, but she's not the same kind of trouble that St. Jimmy is. She's a very positive revolutionary, whereas St. Jimmy is kind of more like a wallowing in the filth revolutionary.
Right.
And that's sort of what leads to In Extraordinary Girl, where, you know, she's alone every night. He can't really bring himself to really be with her. And it's clearly not going to last because they aren't trouble like each other.
Right. So after Extraordinary Girl is my favorite song in the album, Letter Bomb, which
and
I jam
also
out
my
to
favorite
all
song.
The time. It's so good. So the Letter Bomb in this case is a letter that What's Her Name gave or sent to St. Jimmy or to Jesus, saying, like, nobody likes you. You keep bringing these problems upon yourself. You need to work on yourself. Letter Bomb is another one that has a lot of great words and references. The very first line, where have all the bastards gone, is a reference to Holding Out for a Hero, which has the line, where have all the good men gone? It's sort of like the bastards in this case is the people that, like, Jesus either hung out with or was so against, but, like, he doesn't see them anymore. They're either more, like, underground or they're more outright bastards while not being labeled as such. You know, he says, like, the underbelly stacks up 10 high, the underbelly being that, like, corporate criminal underworld, not necessarily the back alley, but, like, the executive suite.
Yeah, the underbelly can be either the, like, you know, back alley, sort of, you know, where the homeless hang out, the druggies hang out, that sort of thing. But I do very much like the interpretation that the underbelly is not, it's the much cleaner bad side that no one wants to address. It's the backroom deals. It's the corporate interest. It's that.
Right. So, there's also, what's it called? There's also, like, what's in love is now in debt on your birth certificate, which is a reference to the line from Jesus of Suburbia to fall in love and fall in debt. So, like, that part's already happened. He's already done drugs. He's already pretty much sought out to escape everything he was, but he hasn't been able to. And then the pre-chorus is, like, the town bishop's an extortionist. He don't even know that you exist. It's both, like, the bishop is a criminal and doesn't know you exist, so you're not that this big time hero everybody thinks about. The bishop being a criminal is sort of another biblical reference of like, Jesus wants to think he's both holy and a criminal. He wants to think that he's both this like savior figure and somebody who can enact change in the world through violence. But like, he's not, he's not known by this bishop who's a holy man that uses that, you know, is criminal. Also, it's like the bishop doesn't care about the people in the church. He doesn't know who they are. The bishop just wants money. So like, any sort of search for help in the church isn't really found by Jesus.
Yeah. I do want to bring up, I think you mentioned Fight Club at some point. And I do want to bring up Fight Club very briefly, just because I think that there is no small amount of parallels, and especially at around this time, there were no small amount of parallels of like the angry anarchist, basically. And I think what makes American Idiot so wonderful and timeless is that something like Fight Club had a Tyler Durden character, but the Tyler Durden character was really badass. Like, yeah, the Tyler Durden character was, you know, a violent fascist dictator, but like, wasn't he also cool as hell? And that leads to, you know, the sort of current basically misunderstanding of Fight Club and misunderstanding of those types of characters, where it's like, no, the point is that these people, while even no matter what they're justified in fighting against, these people are effectively no better than the system. Whereas with American Idiot and with Letterbomb, it addresses the fact that, yes, you are correct to, you know, you are correct, certainly, to feel this disenfranchisement, to feel this rage, but being a Saint Jimmy, being a figure that sort of is just a face of violence that has really no end goal, really nothing to do, you're not actually helping any of your disciples. You're not actually helping anybody by just sort of being this aimless anger.
Right. Letterbomb has a lot of other great lines, like, I mean, it's not over till you're underground is sort of what the chorus repeats, which is that, again, like, you can always turn your life around because you're not dead. Then it has, like, the city's burning, it's not my burden. The burning city he dreamed about in Are We the Waiting is already happening. It's just not something that he enacted and not something that he cares to stop. I think it's that realization that the underbelly, which is where the real criminals are, quote-unquote, is happening without him. But then, of course, the best part is the catharsis in like the last pre-chorus, which kind of returns to all of the motifs in the album.
Yeah,
where he says
the line of you're not the Jesus of suburbia. The Saint Jimmy is a figment of your father's rage and your mother's love made me the idiot America. It is. I think that this is the song that, like, you can least sort of take out as its own song and listen to without the entire album as context. And that's why I love it, especially because of that specific line.
Right, yeah. It's like, you aren't a savior. Saint Jimmy is just something you made up to deal with sort of the conflicting emotions of your life and the stress. And all of that only served to make you the very person you didn't want to be. American Idiot.
I want to also put a focus on I think like the bridge before the last pre-chorus of where will all the martyrs go when the virus cures itself, and where will we all go when it's too late. I personally interpret the it's too late as death, basically. Right. So like, because I think that fits well with, like, it's not over before it's too late. Like, it's not over until you die. It's not over until the fat lady sings. And so I think that where will all the martyrs go when the virus cures itself is, I mean, I certainly want to say that that's a very timely line as well, given what we're currently living in. But that is, such a wonderful, poignant line, both within the context of the album, within the context of, like, I personally interpret that as sort of like, where does, like, it's partially like, where will we bury our dead soldiers when this war is over? But it's also more broad as like, where do we go? Like, what is the next step of revolution? What is the next step of this anger and this hate? And like, what's her name, I think, embodies the love aspect and the fact that there is a next step. But where will all the martyrs go when the virus cures itself is a very poignant line, because I think it's sort of like you have this rage you're creating just to sort of deal with your shit, but you're not asking yourself what's next.
Yeah. It also sort of is like, viruses don't cure themselves. And so implying that, like, we're waiting for it to cure itself and we just have these martyrs on the way sort of implies that we're going to just have a constant string of deaths.
Yeah.
Of people, like, giving themselves up for a fight that won't end, because we actually have to find cures to viruses. So going back to sort of the anti-war theme, it's like people are going to give up their lives constantly until we actually stop the war. The war just won't end because it happens to end by itself. It only ends because people want it to end, because people sign it to stop.
Yeah.
Stuff like that.
Which I mean, I would say is an extremely good call on their part, considering the war still isn't over.
Yeah. So yeah, Letterbomb. Oh, it also just has at the very end, the last sort of signal that what's her name actually did leave. And that's sort of the line that closes out the song, is that, like, what's her name left Jesus and the town.
Yeah.
Two more, or there's three more songs on the album. The next one is Wake Me Up When September Ends. This was written as sort of a tribute to Billy Joe's dad dying. I believe it said he died in 87. I'm not sure. Please forgive me if I forgot that fact or got it wrong.
Yeah,
but a lot of the lines are because, like, his dad died in September, and supposedly the Wake Me Up When September Ends is something he told his mom because he wanted to lock himself in his room and just sleep the whole time. And, like, you know, every time when September comes, he gets reminded of that. And so, like, the autumn and September as a whole are these, like, really difficult moments for him.
Wake Me Up When September Ends is kind of disconnect, like, it's, I wouldn't say disconnected, but, like, it's very easy to sort of take out of the album.
Well, it was originally written for their previous album.
Yeah.
The one that got the master tape stolen. I think they didn't record it because Billy Joe wasn't in a good state of mind to record it at the time. But then when they recorded for American Idiot, he wanted to go ahead and do it. So, it feels disconnected on, because it kind of is. But it still works.
Yeah, it works extremely well with the album, but, like, it's also just, it's such a wonderful song on its own. There's a reason that it's, you know, one of the songs of the album that, like, is still really exceptionally popular, because, like, it is such a wonderful song for just being so overwhelmed that you just don't want to acknowledge anything, don't want to deal with anything. You want to fall asleep until just all the interesting parts are over, basically.
Also, this song gave us a meme that you can only do on one day of every year, which I always love. It's Gonna Be Me by Backstreet Boys. Or was that NSYNC? I don't remember. Anyways, yeah, Wake Me Up When September Ends is this really... I mean, like, I find it depressing, but that's kind of the point. It's very moody, very melodramatic, but also, like, very resonant because of that.
Yeah. I think in the context of the album, this is the, like, it's obvious, the obvious interpretation is that it's the depression of What's-Her-Name having left, but I think it's also the acceptance that Jesus of Suburbia knows he has to go back to his old home. He knows that he's going to have to just be another cog in the machine. And it's just sort of that, like, the process of basically grieving that his days of Teenage Rebellion are over, and he's going to have to become the thing that he fought against for so long just to survive.
Yeah. That also carries into the next song, Homecoming, which,
yeah.
Again, Homecoming started as a series of 30-second jam sessions that the band did, where they each tried to outdo each other with their compositions, which is very noticeable because Homecoming's kind of all over the place musically. It jumps around in BPM, in tone, in style, rhythm, melody.
Yeah, I think that, it's a little bit obvious that Jesus of Suburbia was written after, because I think Jesus of Suburbia has a more obvious through line. But when I say that, I also want to clarify that I think Homecoming is extremely good. And I think that disconnectedness works very well with like the ending of the album. It's not the exact end. It's the penultimate song. But like it works very well with that sort of like time is now just sort of flowing forward without any real one thing that's actually sticking out to Jesus. You know, there's not a bunch of individual events happening anymore. He's just filling out paperwork. He's daydreaming. He's, you know, falling asleep at his sofa. And it's the like Gen X hell of like being a office worker who has everything you should, but not feeling any satisfaction from it.
Right. I like that there's the line, he'd rather be doing something else now, like cigarettes and coffee with the underbelly, which again kind of reinforces the underbelly as the corporate underworld. That like, it's not people who do drugs and heroin, it's cigarettes and coffee. You know, like
yeah.
Mobsters or madmen or what have you.
Yeah.
The first movement is it frames Saint Jimmy as a Santa Claus figure. It says like bearing gifts and drugs. Saint Jimmy comes in the night.
Yeah.
And then like Saint Jimmy says like we're fucked up but we're not the same and mom and dad are the ones who to blame, which again kind of goes back to the father's rage and mother's love. What happens after that is it's hard to tell if... So, obviously, this is all taking place in Jesus' mind. It's hard to tell if St. Jimmy was, like, removed of his own accord, or if it was just, like, something Jesus grew out of, or what have you. It's called, like, My Own Private Suicide by the narrator.
Yeah.
So, like, Jesus isn't killing himself. Jimmy is, I guess. It's sort of just moving on from that, though. Saint Jimmy is no longer necessary, no longer a thing that Jesus wants to interact with. Also, interestingly, this is the first time Jesus of Suburbia is just referred to as Jesus in East 12th Street. Previously, it always says Jesus of Suburbia, but now it's just, like, he's on a first-name basis. Like, he's just a guy named Jesus.
Yeah.
Filling out paperwork. And then the I've got a rock and roll van, like all that is a letter sent to Jesus of Suburbia by his friend. This was actually apparently an album liner. I don't think the version I have has this, but it was like, it's an album liner that was a picture of this letter sent to Jesus of Suburbia. And this is also the only line sung by Trey Cool in the album, I believe. Maybe not the album, but at least this song. And so, like, they do kind of pay attention to whose characters are whose throughout the album. I think Mike Dirnt sings most of the St. Jimmy portions, but I'm not super certain on that. But yeah, Trey Cool is the one who does this, like, rock and roll personality. So it's not St. Jimmy that did that, or not Jesus that did that. He says, like, get off of my case. Like, Jesus has just been bugging him the whole time, and he's like, no, I'm good. Just be by yourself. Also, what's kind of funny is during the part where this character says, I haven't drank or smoked again in over 22 days, Billy Joe sings Don't Want to Be an American Idiot over it in the background. So, like, either this character is, like, the rock star that got up and then succeeded and then sang American Idiot, or this rock star is perpetuating the idiot lifestyle.
Yeah.
I think it's sort of like an admission that by being these rock stars that are like fairly popular, they kind of have bought into that American idiot lifestyle themselves. So like, even if they preach against it, they do kind of realize they are enabling it.
Yeah. It's hard to, even as far as this album went at the time, it's hard to like go the extra mile when you also have to sell albums, basically.
Yeah. And yeah, pretty much the end of the album is him like returning home, you know, just going home, going back to where he started to do this facility job. There's not a whole lot else to say. It's very like, it's a triumphant return in terms of the instruments, but it's not at all a triumphant return in terms of story. I mean, maybe it is if you view it as like Jesus getting over his personal problems and trying to like settle down. I think there's a really interesting line that's like, go-karts and guns are treasures they'll bear in the summer heat, which is just like, you know, the people that grow up in this small town, they're not particularly like they are materialist, but they don't care about these expensive things. It's just like go-karts and guns, more fleeting, like very visceral, but also very like metallic and kind of backwater things. Like, when I picture go-karts that you would buy, I don't picture like nice ones you go to an amusement park and ride. I picture like these kind of rusted metal cages.
Yeah. It's they're treasures, but they're treasures in the exact same way that, say, like, you know, the 7-Eleven writing is scriptures. It's yeah. That like, you know, these are the treasures of people who have enough to buy things every now and again, but aren't well off.
Also, in this point, he says, send a letter bomb to my beloved and like she'll miss me in hell or something like that, which is just like the one last letter that Jesus sends to what's her name. Like, he kind of wants to get back in a way to say, like, I've moved on. But also, like, he kind of knows that he'll go to hell, I guess. Like, he kind of admits that he isn't a better person than she is.
Yeah, it's he's gotten over his St. Jimmy phase. He's sort of moved on and resigned himself to be responsible. But he also knows that, like, that's really not enough. But that's also just sort of all he really knows how to do.
There is also a reference to 7-Eleven. So, like, it's come full circle in terms of location in that regard. And then also, this is the first album where it actually directly says Jingletown. Fun fact.
Yeah, that's you, and to you and me in Jingletown, that's home. We're coming home again.
Yeah.
Homecoming is I like that you brought up that it's very triumphant, because like it is, and that's such a great like irony in the song, because I think that, like I said, I think that the idea of, you know, being an office worker in a dead-end job is this like Gen X hell. This like there's this archetype of, you know, the data entry office monkey who just sort of, you know, does work, goes home, watches TV, goes to bed, and that's all he does for the rest of his life. And it's a very like 90s sort of I want to do more sort of thing. And I think it has some resonance nowadays. I think that resonance is a little bit lesser, just because it's a very Gen X hell, but the millennial hell is like being an Uber driver. The millennial hell is, you know, doing Uber Eats. We aren't the generation of even office work. We would cut off our legs to get a stable office position that pays $40,000 a year. We're the generation of forced 24/7 entrepreneurs, as Selmers from Night in the Woods would put it.
I there is one more song in the album I want to cover before doing another like sweep over it thematically.
Yeah. What's her name?
Yeah. The last song is What's Her Name, which is this very sad, kind of depressing song. Again, to me, it was depressing, about like him just kind of remembering what's her name. Can't even remember her face or her actual name. He remembers like what he did and the time he had, but he doesn't remember her, and he doesn't want to remember her. Like, he says, I made a point to burn all of the photographs. Like, he forgot to burn all the actual physical memories, but also, like, he wanted to burn all those physical memories.
Yeah, I forgot to remember to forget.
Yeah. And then also, there's, like, towards the end, it's him, like, really desperately trying to force himself to push what's-her-name out of his mind completely, just saying the word go over and over again. And then finally, the last line on the album, which I think is the one that's the most contested on Genius, he says, "Forgetting you, but not the time." I think this is, like, again, he wants to forget what's-her-name because he wants to move on from that. The Homecoming and Letter Bomb and all that, and kind of like September, all of that were songs that had some element of what's-her-name haunting him. Like, he really wanted to be in love again. And I think this is his admission that, like, that will never pass. I've been holding on too long, even if I don't think I have. I can remember the good times, but I shouldn't get hung up on the person.
Yeah, it's... What's-her-name is a song of sort of losing your... trying to lose yourself and not being able to, I think. It's... He will... He might one day forget her. He might one day forget, you know, finally succeed. But it's kind of impossible to ever completely separate yourself from that time that you had. You know, I can't remember any of the big details of, like, my high school life. I can't remember the day-to-day, but, like, the experiences that I had there, the experiences that you have at your college, that you have, you know, when you're young, they are inevitably a part of you. And so even if you have a lost love, even if you, you know, have something very big happen that you want to just completely block out, you will forever be shaped by that experience.
Kind of to go back over the album, I think there's a few major things now that we can kind of better piece together. The Rage and Love as a whole is sort of like this juxtaposition of America in a way. Like, we want to believe that we're doing the right thing, but we are filled with rage. I say we in, like, I don't mean everybody, of course. I know saying we in this sort of an analytical situation can be kind of tricky, but I mean, like, the people that American Idiot is criticizing are people that both want to believe they are loving, but are filled with rage. And that tension, that struggle is, like, that's the heart of people, I guess. Like, it's hard to escape in that and only have rage and only have love. I mean, I guess it's easy to only have rage, but it's hard to only have love. And managing those is this active battle.
I think the thing that really pulls American Idiot together and gives it that timeless feel is What's-Her-Name. Because it's very easy to make a, like, full album that is just whinging, for lack of a better word. That is, and, you know, justified whinging, but, like, that is just that rage. That is just that anger of, you know, our government has betrayed us. People are dying around us. We can't do anything about it. And it's very easy to just buy into that. But What's-Her-Name is in the story an activist, is somebody who is taking that, you know, that sort of not really conducive to a actual sort of, you know, actionable state and actually giving people something to do with it. She is actually forwarding some kind of cause. And so the problem that St. Jimmy and the problem that Jesus of Suburbia, like, sort of punch against is that they don't have that forward thinkingness. They can't escape just sort of the aimless rage. And so when the aimless rage is gone, Jesus of Suburbia doesn't really have that pointed place to go afterwards. He has a house, but he will never have a home.
Yeah, the like holding hand grenade heart symbol, now that we've kind of looked over everything that refers to it, it's both directly talking about What's-Her-Name. She is on the cover of the album in a way, but, like, also, it's this sort of look that, like, you can't really have a safe home. There's going to be struggles and there's going to be issues. And there are good ways to deal with those and bad ways.
Yeah.
And Jesus of Suburbia is somebody who didn't really look for the good ways.
Yeah. I think that the image of a heart, of holding onto a heart like a hand grenade, is also extremely, like, it's extremely powerful because, like, the, you know, the fist in the air is a very popular revolution symbol even nowadays. And, you know, a hand grenade is inherently violent, but the heart is inherently good. And so I think it's this, like, this one image symbol of, like, yes, you can be angry, but you can use that anger to do something good.
Mm-hmm. I think the last major theme that's not just, like, related to war is that there is this sense of hopelessness and, like, destiny throughout the album. The idea that, like, it's almost inescapable to try to rebel, fail, and then end up being the adult that you tried to rebel against.
Yeah.
Like, that's why it's so triumphant when he goes home, is that he's, like, giving in to this destiny. You know, he falls in love and falls in debt, like it's sort of prophesized. Everything, you know, he criticizes others for not caring, but in the end, he doesn't care. And I think the reason why What's-Her-Name haunts him so much isn't just that he liked her and he was in a relationship, but that What's-Her-Name was the person who escaped that fate. What's-Her-Name's path that she took was one that led her to being fulfilled in this sort of political activism. And Jesus of Suburbia views that as, like, an escape from the monotony that he tried to do and failed. And so, like, we're sort of meant to empathize with Jesus because, you know, it's very easy to just kind of feel hopeless and feel like you can't change your destiny. But much like Jesus, we're supposed to aim for What's-Her-Name. What's-Her-Name is the idealized person here. Not only is she, you know, the person he loves, but she's the example of somebody who can make change for the better.
Yeah.
She is the only one who is not the American idiot.
Yeah. To speak just sort of like outside the album, but also on the themes, I do like this album. I really love this album. I really love the themes. And I really think that it was very good, very timely, and still holds up a lot. But I also really like this album because I think that it's an album we've almost sort of like moved past. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean that in a very good way, because like the end result of this album is that resignation. It is that, you know, falling back into the person you hate. But nowadays we have a lot of music, a lot of young people who are extremely active, who are, you know, fighting for all kinds of, you know, political goals that are extremely attainable if, you know, young people really get into it, get up to it. And so, like, this idea that going to an office job in your 30s is the end of your life, I call that the Gen X hell, not just because that's something that millennials really kind of can't even attain, but also because your 30s aren't the end of your life. Like, a lot of people do not know what they want to do until their late 40s. My parents didn't, like, meet and marry until their mid-30s and didn't have us until their late 30s. Like, this idea that, you know, having to be an office drone, a wage slave, is just sort of it, and then you can never have another revolutionary bone in your body again, that's just wrong. And we've seen multiple times that that's been proven wrong. And so I think that American Idiot is a wonderful thing to go back to and a wonderful thing to analyze, because I think it's in some ways been proven wrong.
Yeah, it's a parable of like who not to be. And I think that people nowadays follow this parable as like, oh, cautionary tale. And I think that's why this is a better Fight Club than Fight Club.
Yes.
Welcome to my 40-hour YouTube video, Fight Club Sucks, and Here's Why.
yeah, it's don't be a Tyler Durden. Yeah. It's kind of the the end result. And I think that that's what American Idiot also kind of the message is as well.
Yeah, that being self-destructive isn't how you find social revolution. It's through being supportive of other people and being understanding of other people.
Yeah. And don't get us wrong. Be as gay as you want and do as many crimes as you want. But the end result of being gay and doing crimes should be a better world.
Yeah. All right.
For legal purposes, we cannot say that you should actually do crimes.
Yes. We take no responsibility for crimes committed by listeners to this.
Or any unwarranted gayness that is committed by any listeners of this podcast.
But warranted gayness, you know, is always welcome.
Oi, bruv, you got a warrant for that gayness.
I do. Oh, well, all right then. Guess you're good to go. Thanks for checking. I had like 50 accents during that entire phrase there.
Very, very multicultural. Very American.
Yes. I think that about does it for our episode. It was a long one.
Yeah.
Go listen to this album. It's great.
I think we should just do a couple of very basic social call-outs for the end here.
Yeah.
You can follow us on Twitter at NetSurferPro. Please tweet at us any, you know, ideas for other episodes you might want to hear. We also tweet out sort of, you know, hints as to what the next episode might be.
You can follow me on Twitter at Matt Craig Gaming, where I tweet things I do and work on. You can also follow me on Twitch at twitch.tv/twack, twitch.tv/twak. I stream Monday, Wednesday, Friday from about 1 p.m. Central Time to 3 or 4 p.m. Central Time, except tomorrow, the 25th of March of 2021, I'll be streaming Risk of Rain 2 because the anniversary update's coming out. You can also follow me on YouTube at youtube.com/ieatsonic. That's IEATATSONIC, where I make videos on different video games, and I've been uploading some tournament VODs of a pretty cool video game. And check out Board Game Bros, my other podcast.
Yes. You can find me on Twitter at Galen Wilson. That's GALENWILS0N. I tweet out hot takes. You can follow me on YouTube at The Only Galen on YouTube. I might actually have a video sometime soon, hopefully. Fingers crossed. You can also find me on Twitch at Machine Gun Vampire. I might be streaming this Saturday a D&D game that stars the very own Matt that you are listening to, as well as another online friend.
That's me. The first one, not the second one.
But with that, thank you very much for listening.
Thank you. We're leaving. We're leaving this podcast. Do 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 do